It's 8:14. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, as we just reported, the Park City Board of Education approving up to $200,000 for the remodel of the high school library so it can serve as the new location for the PC CAPS program. In the studio with me, I have Park City School Board member Julie Eihausen. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning.
So were you surprised by the more than doubling of the cost from a $60,000 remodel to a $200,000 expense?
I actually asked about that yesterday. From what I understand, the $60,000 figure was an error from the very beginning. And when we did first get that, it did seem a little bit low to me, but you know, I didn't really understand what they were doing. So anyway, I did talk to Todd Haber, and he said that that was a complete error, that when they were originally talking about the design, they were thinking it was going to be maybe $120,000 to $150,000, but that didn't include architectural fees or design fees. So that's why we went ahead and went up to the 200. And building costs are starting to rise. So we just wanted to make sure they had enough to actually get it done, because we do need to have that done for next school year.
So this wouldn't have been a stopping block or anything to move forward with grade realignment had you known the real cost of it?
No, I don't believe so.
Yeah, but this isn't the first time this has happened. I mean, maybe should staff just present doubled prices to you? Because it seems like we've seen this happen over and over again, where it comes in at a price and then we see a double or tripling of the final cross project.
The only time that I can actually remember that happening is, of course, with the PC CAPS building, the remodel that we did in the retail space. I don't believe that the oversight that really needs to happen on some of these projects necessarily happened in that instance, but we will be watching the costs for this.
All right. Any concern, though, that we're doing this piecemeal, given that we do need an addition to put the ninth grade back in there because of grade realignment?
Well, I think it's a timing issue, because we do need to be ready for PC CAPS students to be back in the high school by next year to be able to orchestrate the remodel that we need to get the ninth graders into the high school. That's really pushing it if we try to do all of that when we do have a very obvious deadline for the PC CAPS remodel. So I see this library remodel as like the first step of us getting totally prepared for the 16-17 grade realignment for the entire district.
So is the idea, though, that we will build a new media center and that this stays put as the PC CAPS location?
No, this is a combined use space. This is not just a PC CAPS area. In fact, we're talking about starting to hold our school board meetings in that space. So there are some areas that are going to be locked off, like the robotics, or, you know, areas that have specific equipment that can't be used by anybody. But the bulk of the area is going to be a multi-use space, and it won't be just designated for PC CAPS.
Hmm. So we will not have to undo the $200,000 that we're putting into this space.
I would have a really hard time voting to do that.
Yeah. So it's only PC CAPS then two periods out of the day, and then the rest it's a media center?
It's a media center. It's also like a conference area. So if you know, classes need to meet for, you know, a collaboration or for any other reason. And it also, from what I understand, it also can be used for a professional development area.
Yeah. Any concern, though, that the stakeholders really weren't consulted on this, those being the students and the librarian?
For the remodel?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, librarians' jobs or descriptions are changing, and media centers are changing. We are trying to have more of a gathering place, more like a center that they have in a college campus. And I don't know that the students weren't talked to or weren't didn't have any kind of input. I would assume that there was some level of input, because the spaces are specifically designed for some, or there's some classes that have specific needs, and they were designed for that.
All right. And what about parking? My understanding is that there is none for the mentors and the dozens of business folk that come in to help with the CAPS program.
We have not seen the drawings for that. We do know that parking is an issue. Master planning is aware of that. But we have not seen a final drawing. We have seen like a preliminary rendering. That is not even the approved final drawing for the interior.
Okay. And then what costs so much? I mean, what's the $150,000 for? I mean, it's just putting up some walls, no?
Again, we don't have the final. Mm-hmm. And when I spoke to Todd Hauber yesterday, he did say that that was the estimate based on the, you know, building costs that they have so far. Yeah. So I don't know specifically what those are. We definitely will have that information before it, you know, moves forward.
Yeah. I mean, is it some rewiring cost, or you don't really know what the scope of the work is?
We don't know because mm-hmm. we didn't see a final plan. All we saw was an original rendering.
All right. Yesterday, you also got a brief master planning update from the superintendent. Now that the decision's been made to go ahead with GRE alignment, the charge now is to figure out what we're going to do about the temporary solutions until that fifth, sixth grade building gets built and modifications to the high school. So what are we talking about doing?
Well, in my mind, the timeline is we do the library remodel, so we have PC caps in the high school next year. And then we have an entire year to remodel the high school before ninth grade, you know, needs to move in there in the 16-17 year. What I personally would like to see is 7-8 go into Ecker and have the 5-6 be temporarily housed, possibly, in Treasure Mountain for a year until we can get the 5-6 school built. I was under the impression that because the 5-6 school would be smaller and maybe less detailed, that they could do that in a year. Master planning has since come back and said, that's pie in the sky. We have to go. It's going to be 18 months. So rather than rush the design and, you know, rush through everything, I can see temporarily housing them. Personally, I would rather not have kids in trailers, but I'm one vote of five, so...
What about full-day kindergarten? Does that also start the 16-17 year, or is that supposed to go in, or does that go in the this year, the 15-16?
No, 16-17 is what some people are referring to as the golden year. Other people are calling it the apocalypse. So it just depends on your point of view, but that's kind of when a lot of these changes are going to be implemented. And I don't know where we're going to be as far as different start times, different bus routes. I mean, all of that stuff has to be talked about. We're talking about the 5-6 potentially being on Bear Hollow or potentially being on the Ecker campus. There's pros and cons for both of those. The Bear Hollow property has some restrictions as far as building. We have to go through the county process rather than just letting them know what we're going to do. So if there is a timing issue, it may be a better choice to pick the Ecker campus. However, there's multiple things to consider before we make that decision. But master planning, that's the reason that they're meeting every week and that they're being so thoughtful about looking at all kinds of options. So when they present to the board, they've actually thought things out. And you can say, well, did you think about this? And they can say, yeah, this is why we discounted that. So.
All right. So this next school year will look very much like it does today, with the exception of PC caps.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the football team wanting to go to Preston, Idaho for a game. What did the school board decide on that request, travel request?
We decided to go ahead and approve it for this year, kind of because it had already been approved. It was extended last year. An additional year was added to it. But with that approval, we did say it will not be, or actually Dr. Connolly said the administration has been advised that they are not to ask because it won't be approved for another year.
So why is that? Just too far of a drive, or?
I did ask about that because that it is. It's too far of a drive, and it also doesn't give us an additional opportunity or an enhanced opportunity to play. Supposedly the level of the Preston team, we can find that same level of competition down in the valley where we don't have to drive so far.
Yeah, and that's what the reason for going to Preston was it was a similar caliber team? Is that why we were making the drive?
I honestly don't know, because this is now the third year mm-hmm. of this, and I don't really remember the original approval, you know, 3 years ago, but from what I understand, they just have a relationship with Preston, Idaho, and they wanted to have the competition with that team.
All right. The board also spent 2 hours yesterday on governing policy. Is this the first time you've done something like this, or that you're aware of?
Governance is a big issue for a lot of the members that are on the school board, because we feel that if we have policies and procedures in place, then a lot of situations can tend to resolve themselves where you don't have, you know, public uproar. So what we're doing is Nancy Garrison is heading the governance committee, and she's making a list of everything that we need to work on, and then we're kind of dividing and conquering. So like our policy, I've taken on the policy, so which is the policy of how we create policy, and also public comment on the restructure for that. So when we submit our drafts, then we as a board can decide, yeah, we want to adopt that or not. Tanya and JJ are working on a board handbook, so it actually has some guidelines for new board members to see, these are your responsibilities, you know, these are the duties that you have, and this is what is expected of you.
So this came about just because we've got some new people on the board, and they're just like, there was nothing like this for us, and we want to make sure it is for others?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So at the end of the day, I mean, what will you have to give? Just a booklet then, just kind of outlining all of this stuff?
Well, we should have a board handbook. We should have guidelines for public comment and a restructure for public comment. We should have, again, the policy. We should have... I'm trying to think of the list of all the stuff on governance. Basically, the guidelines of how the board is going to run is what we should have. We should have, you know, the guidelines for the board meeting dates, you know, what's expected as far as that we do expect to have two a month, even if we have a break.
Yeah. Board members, new board members also receive some training, I believe, from the state. Was
yes.
that just not helpful enough? Didn't just go far enough or wasn't specific enough?
No, actually, that training helped us see that we need to have some more guidelines actually in place so we know what we're supposed to be doing.
All right. Finally, I wanted to ask you about, are we starting to advertise then for Mo Hickey's position?
Yes. Today actually is the press release that, because Mo will be stepping down the end of June. So June 1st, let's see, the timeline for selection. By June 1st, we need a completed application. By June 9th, the candidates will be interviewed during an open meeting. We do need to interview during an open meeting. So if you are a candidate, you can't be in the open meeting, but the public can certainly be there. And then by June 16th, we will be able to announce the new school board member because we would like them to be able to hit the ground running when school starts in August.
Yeah. So say you get a half dozen people who are interested. What are you going to be looking for personally in a new board member?
I want someone who is very passionate about Park City and our education. I want someone who has an interest in the schools, has an interest in the students, and is looking for excellence. We kind of list our criteria. We want them to have some experience in community leadership, be an independent thinker, potentially have legal, finance, or business background, an interest in following the state legislature, because that was something that Mo did very well for us. A diverse background or an interest in representing the needs of all the students, and then excellent communication and listening skills, be a team player. We really do want to add another member to our team. And then they also do need to have the ability to devote 10 to 15 hours a week to the work of the board.
Do you think that's all you spend, 15 hours a week?
Well, I when you put me on the spot there, Leslie, I probably spend maybe 25 hours a week. But that is something that, you know, I've been volunteering for a long time, and that's just an hour level that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah. So. Certainly your afternoon and evening meetings are probably easier for the working person. Is that a consideration? I mean, do you have to be able to be there for those 9 a.m. work session meetings?
That's a conversation that each board can have. And so with a new board member coming on, if the 9 o'clock meetings don't really work in their schedule, then we could certainly have a discussion about switching all of the meetings to the 4 o'clock. One of the reasons that we did switch to the 9 o'clock is because it's a little bit easier to schedule a long meeting if you start at 9 rather than starting at 4, especially you have to remember we have a closed session typically for an hour before. So for us, those afternoon meetings start at 3. And when you start getting into the later evening hours, we get a little glossy-eyed.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add, Julie?
No, just to remind everybody that graduation is coming up and all of our year-end school activities are culminating, and it's very exciting.
All right, Julie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's Park City School Board member Julie Eihausen. KPCW News Time now, 8:30. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Joining me now in the studio from Park City Municipal, I have City Manager Diane Foster, Jed Briggs with the Budget Department, and Brooke Moss with Human Resources. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Let's start with you, Diane, real quick. The solar panels at the MARC, this is at this point Summit County's largest solar panel array. We had thought that it was going to be done any day now, but driving by, couldn't even see the panels on the front side.
They don't have them on the front side, but you'll see cones. I was just over at the MARC at a yoga class with a number of city council members. There's a great new 7 a.m. yoga class on Wednesdays if people are interested. And we had some issues with some warranty issues. So, and making sure that when we put the panels in, you have to attach them to the roof. And so making sure that we don't void the warranty. So we were doing some work with the contractor on that one, but they've got actually all the clips in for the panels. So I think we'll see those go up pretty quickly. And I will tell you, Council, because Summit County is going to be putting on a larger array on their policing facility, I think, and that's going to
Justice Center,
and that'll be going up about a month after ours. Liza asked if we can add two more panels so we can stay the biggest.
Well, you also learned that the project exceeds Rocky Mountain Power's current net metering standards, exceeding a 10% on-grid generation standard by 2.5%. So what does that mean?
You know, it's interesting. Our house is a nearly net zero house, which means that we generate nearly as much energy as we use. And distributed generation is a difficult problem for power companies because they have to do a lot of planning. You know, they're required to provide us power, and so, but they need to optimize their systems because they don't want to overproduce. So they have a limit on a single facility that you can generate 10% of your total power or the amount that you're putting into the grid for those size facilities, for big facilities. And a house like mine, I can put more than 100% of my home use back into the grid. And because of the size, it's not going to cause them a problem. But with a facility like the MARC that has air conditioning, it can cause the power company challenges in planning. So we're doing some work with them on that, and we're confident we can work it out.
So you weren't aware of the limitations kind of going into this?
I don't know if staff was aware of it, but actually Matt Abbott is working on the Public Service Commission, and you know, solar regulation in Utah is always a moving target and something that we're actually sitting on a committee with. Matt is sitting on a committee with the Public Service Commission on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, had we known of the limitations, would we have gone this big or just?
I imagine we would have. Okay. This was a huge city council commitment. This is our first solar array that is not being paid for by grant. And so that's a significant commitment of $450,000 by the city council. But unlike most heating systems, it actually has a payback. You know, so that's unusual. And so while it's a multi-year payback, you know, city council felt like this is one of our community values. This is one of their values, and they wanted to move forward with it.
All right. Also, real quick, the Utah legislature this year enacted a last-minute law removing requirements for local license on taxis and other TNCs. They're known as transportation network companies. So will that impact the city's current taxi laws that we have? I mean, you require someone to come in and get a license to do business here, and that was to protect the local taxi company businesses, as
yeah,
I recall.
This is all about Uber. At the end of the day, there are other companies that are similar to Uber, but Uber is kind of the model. There's another company, Lyft's, and this has to do with our ability to force those people to be licensed. So we are in a changing landscape, and our legislative liaison, Matt Dias, assistant city manager, has been working on this a lot. So we will be discussing this more with council, and we had this to council a couple months ago.
Yeah. We had a number of city representatives at the state legislature, and this seems like it came as some surprise. I mean, did it fly under the radar?
This one flew under the radar a little bit. I know I recall actually Matt sending updates on how this was going. It is one of those that because, you know, this is a totally new industry and it's very difficult to regulate. And, you know, if you talk to Uber, they say, oh, we're not a taxi company. We're a technology company. And so we're not the first city to struggle with this, and we won't be the last. Most people, I think, feel like the direction of this regulation is probably where the market's going to go.
All right. What's next with regard to growth? In March, the council talked about wanting to start these discussions on growth. Sounds like staff has developed at least a plan for that.
We do have a plan on June 15th, so put that on your calendars. We'll be hosting a community discussion on growth. And that's intended. City Council wants to have a very frank discussion with the community to talk about what are the factors, what are the current entitlements, what is our community going to look like in the future, even if we don't entitle a single new piece of density. what is already going to happen both in and around our community. And so I think that's a very respectful conversation for the council and the community to have with one another. One other thing I do want to remind you, and thank you for covering this, the library is closing this Sunday, May 10th. They will reopen on June 13th with a book brigade and a big celebration for the community. And Leslie, I believe you've been through it. It's a beautiful building, and the library staff and the whole city and the project team led by Jonathan Weidenhammer and Dave Gustafson and Matt Twombly are very excited about it.
Okay, well, let's turn to the budget. This is the second year of a two-year budget, so what we do is we adjust the current year budget and then set next fiscal year's budget. Basically, that most of the work for that has been done, I'm guessing, Jed?
Yeah, I mean, we always, in the off year, try to do less than we did in the on year, so we're in the off year right now, so we kind of make tweaks, basically.
How much of an adjustment are we talking about?
So overall in the operating budget, if you look in our staff report, we're saying the operating budget is about $56.3 million. So that's about a 3.5% increase over last year, about $2 million or so. The good news is we're not asking for any kind of tax increase, that we have a balanced budget. And you know, part of what we do is we look at revenue projections over the next several years, and the revenue projections look pretty good. And so we can meet the community's needs and the demands, and also pay for inflationary costs like pay or health insurance, retirement, without asking the citizens to increase taxes.
Okay, I want to get back to that, but just a real quick date. So you need to have it tentatively adopted then by June 22nd?
We're doing a tentative budget adoption tomorrow around 6 p.m., and we're having a public hearing, so citizens can come if they want. And then we're planning to adopt the final budget on June 18th.
All right. As you look at those projections, though, and I think it's like 6 years from out, once again, those revenue and expenditure lines cross over, mm-hmm. and meaning that now we are in the red. And I think that first year shows it 2024 of about $76,000 or something like this.
Yeah.
But this is, we hear this every year, and it just like it gets just pushed out. And this is, I guess, a question to you. I mean, I remember having this conversation with Toby Ross, with Tom Backley, and certainly with you over the last couple of years. I mean, is this something that you guys learn in public management classes, you know, to tell people that, you know, it's like, well, you know, those lines are going to cross, and beware, we're going to have to raise taxes, but we never do.
We actually do specifically learn about it in our Master's in Public Administration, and it's called the Washington Monument Effect, that the federal government will say, well, we're going to have to take down the Washington Monument. And the reality is we have a very sophisticated budget model that's been developed that recommends a given our revenue increases, a fairly conservative 4.5% year-over-year increase. So it is based on that model, and that's to account for when we have growth in the community, there is an increased demand for services. Now, I will tell you why the line has been pushed. So you're absolutely reflecting a sentiment of city council as well. In fact, I think this drives Andy Bierman crazy. Mm-hmm. And what's been happening is if you look at things like the additional resort communities tax, so the voters approved that and that pushed the line. We will be looking in the next few years, probably not, we're not recommending that we go with a transportation tax to the voters this year, but probably in the presidential election, the county may decide to, this year in the legislature, there was a transportation tax that was approved, but it's a county option tax, so the county voters can choose to levy that tax if we want to. If we do, that would push the line again. So there have been things that have happened either in the economy or in voter approving new taxes that have pushed that line.
And in addition, can I just add that, you know, we try to take a very conservative approach to projecting out our revenues over the next 10 years, because, you know, if the revenues come in higher, we can still budget that in the next year. If they come in lower, then we're in a deficit. And so the economy in Park City keeps exceeding our expectations, and I think that's a good thing for the citizens to hear.
Yeah. Certainly, though, I mean, we always have the choice of cutting expenses.
Oh, yes, definitely.
All right.
And I think if we get to that point where those lines are crossing, we can cut those expenses.
And I will point out, we had significant budget cuts during the recession, and it was a huge reset at that point. To this date, we haven't heard the community nor council say, we want to cut services. And when you say, you know, we can cut expenses, it actually reflects, it means cut services. And this community has, it's a fortunate community, and we have a high level of, you know, you look at the project behind you, it's going to be a significant improvement to public safety and also a beautification project. And that is part of our brand.
Yeah, we can certainly cut projects, like you say. I mean, that is, you know, I mean, people, when they talk about budgets, you know, we talk about wants and we talk about needs, and that truly is a want there.
It is a want. However, I think you've probably walked down there when cars are pulling out in the middle of winter. It's a public safety issue for pedestrians. Also, Sweet Alley, while it's always been the back door, it's increasingly becoming the front door, and I think in 20 years we'll actually see storefronts on this side of the area. And also, really, part of our brand, you know, it is granite. It is nicer granite sidewalks. It is a nicer Main Street.
All right. Let's bring you into the conversation, Brooke, because we're talking about, as part of the budget, redoing the pay plan.
We are making some small changes to the pay plan, which will actually just increase the number of grades and make them smaller. So that actually may save a little bit of money for the city. But what we're looking at changing is the city's pay philosophy. We're really struggling attracting the staff that we need to just get business done. Unemployment in Summit County is 3%. We had a lot of problems before the recession, and we're starting to see those problems again. And it's not just a citywide problem. It's felt by a lot of the different industries in the area. Cost of living in Summit County is much higher than elsewhere in the state. And so we don't anticipate or intend to pay people enough to be able to sustain them in Park City proper or even much of the county. So that also includes a lot of commuting costs. And so to attract the staff that we need, we have to be competitive. So we are looking at adjusting a few things to meet some of our needs.
And are we kind of confined to the building department?
One of the biggest problems we have right now is in building and transit, actually. We are not able to attract building inspectors, and that's a statewide problem. All of the governments are struggling with that. It's the average age in that industry is in the high 50s. There are a lot of them retiring, and there aren't a lot of people replacing them. So when you talk about specific problems like that, it delays construction. It has a huge impact financially for a lot of people in the community, and it's certainly a safety issue to get the quality of people we need. The complexity of projects in Park City is really high. So we've started a lot of programs to try and fix that first. We have a mentorship program. We're encouraging a lot of people in the construction industry to get certified and to start learning those skills. We're training in-house. We've brought in outside contractors, but ultimately none of them have really fixed the problem.
Yeah, but I'm going to go throw this back to you then, Diane. I mean, we're talking about, you know, next month about growth. Right here, we have a natural limit to growth, and yet we're Here's an opportunity to say, well, here, this is a way to slow down growth because we don't have the staff to do it. But what you're proposing is that we pay more so that we can hire more so that we can keep growing growth.
It's actually saying that hiring building inspectors fuels growth is I don't believe is correct from the perspective that there are state laws that regulate how quickly we deliver an inspection. So, for example, there's a state law that says we must complete an inspection within 48 hours. That was a law that was passed last year. With our building inspection shortages, last year we had some challenges in meeting those legal requirements. The other piece is that, you know, growth, you know, we have property rights in the state and we have entitled densities. And I don't believe it's appropriate for the city to use staffing as a way to slow down projects on Main Street or other types of projects. I mean, it's a question for council that, you know, in the past we've said we want to have very good employees at the city, and we've been losing people to other jurisdictions, even those around us like Wasatch County and Heber, who have been paying more than we have. And that's actually a problem, especially when you have to commute in, when most people who work at the city commute into town and can't afford to live in the community.
So we'll be talking about the budget over the next several weeks.
We will, but we're front-loading the pay plan discussion both to give council as well as the public as long as possible to think about it and to consider this. It's very much a policy question, and we've given council a number of options that we're recommending, and some we're recommending. We're actually proposing 5 options of what they could look at, and we're recommending that they implement 3 of the 5 this year, and then we take a look next year.
And how does that impact the budget in terms of increasing it?
Well, we're not asking council to really look at increasing the budget for FY16 in terms of this pay philosophy question. It's something that we'll look at next year, and then we'll come with different options next year.
Okay. In the coming weeks, and I'd like to talk about a little bit about how that budget reflects the council's priorities, because it's interesting to see, you know, I mean, if we're talking about the most important priorities being affordable and attainable housing and transportation, I want to look at how that budget is reflecting those council priorities.
And Leslie, I will tell you, I looked at the capital budget and I nearly fell over, because the capital budget committee heard council loud and clear, and the funding that's being recommended for those areas is significant. And that is a piece that will be coming up in the next few weeks.
Okay, we'll talk about that then. Thanks for all for
Thank
coming
you.
In. 8:47 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Well, with four Historic Preservation Board positions available for reappointment, a majority of the board's makeup needed to conduct business. We're in the studio with details about how to apply and what your commitment will be, as I have a retiring member of the HPB, John Kenworthy, along with the city planner who oversees the HPB, Anya Ground. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So why are we in a position of needing four board members? I mean, usually it's one or two here and there.
Mm-hmm. Well, all four board members, their terms were up, and so it's time to either reapply or, you know, for new people to come in and apply for these positions.
And we've got some good news. We have 9 applicants coming in. And I think in some of us moving on, we're leaving the board in a great shape. I think, you know, the board members that are staying on are going to be cornerstones for the new people that come in.
Right. So it's a 7-person board then?
It is, correct.
All right. And then how long is the term?
3 years.
And can you talk a little
Sure.
bit about the criteria for being a board member?
So the criteria is pretty loose. You do not have to live within the Park City limits. Preferably you live nearby and you have some kind of interest in Park City, obviously. The applications are available online at the city's website. They're due this Friday, May 8th by 5 p.m., The Historic Preservation Board meets usually about once a month. It's the first Wednesday of the month at 5 p.m. in City Council Chambers. The meetings lately have gone a little longer, but they're usually only about an hour or two long. Usually,
and
right?
I really want to compliment the planning and Anya specifically. You know, we've been able to broaden our interest in historic preservation just by the applications that you can see here. We've streamlined the process, and we hopefully have reached out and got through to people that we're here to help. We have grant money. We don't want people stuck in crackerbock houses. We want to help them out. Now, with that being said, historic preservation is critical. It's a huge economic driver for a community, especially Park City, especially our beloved Park City and our beloved Old Town.
Yeah. So why don't you require people on the board to be a city resident?
I'm not exactly sure why there isn't that requirement. I think part of it probably is just that we're a community that probably extends beyond its city limits, and we want, you know, people that have an interest in architecture and preservation to have the opportunity to come and serve on this board.
All right. So is this just an advisory board? I mean, do you actually make decisions?
So
we do make decisions. You know,
or recommendations.
We make both. Some applicants come to us, and the city looks for us for, like they did on the city library. They looked for us just for, you know, our opinion and our recommendations. And then on others, they get appealed from their decision at the planning department, and we are the final say. Just, you know, for the record, the Kimball Arts Center is gone, and we were disappointed as a board that they didn't come to us so that we could continue to stay engaged with them and keep them in Old Town. Hopefully their new location will be here, and you know that we don't lose that sense of community here in Old Town. But we definitely on appeals are this board, and it's so independent and it's so wonderful and it's so diverse. Is the final decision.
Yeah. So when a demolition request comes in, is that something that the HPB decides?
No, it's not. That would be something that the staff would do look at and consider. So the Historic Preservation Board is an appeal body. Like John said, if you get denied with your Historic District Design Review application in the Planning Department, you can appeal it to the Historic Preservation Board. They also review grant applications. They choose an annual Historic Preservation Award. That's the paintings that you see on the main level of City Hall. Let's see. And they also do determination of significance. So if you're in the community and you think your house is historic or you think it shouldn't be historic, the HPB would review that application.
All right. And then when we look at that house, and you may be familiar with it, the one on Woodside, that really looks like, I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful building, don't get me wrong, but it really does not look like it belongs in the historic district. Where was the HPB in that?
That's a great question, and I want to go on the record. Nobody filed an application or an appeal, and it never came to us. Just like the Kimball Arts Center, it never came to us. These things, the community needs the awareness so that now everybody's coming to us, or they stop me over at Flanagan's and say, hey, what happened? How did that house get there? And, you know, at the first time I was asked, I'm like, what house, where? Because we had no idea. But obviously, you know, we're losing a sense of community when a house like that gets built. No question that there, you know, it is not a single family house. It's technically a triplex, but from what I understand, the owner bought out the neighbors, minimized the lockouts, and created, you know, a house that really isn't conforming. And it's certainly not a triplex, as he bought out his neighbors. And, you know, maybe it still has three gas meters and three this and three that. But you see, that's what we're losing here. We're losing that sense of community. And HPB certainly has a role in helping when it comes before us. But those are two things that never came before us.
So that was a planning commission decision?
I'm not sure if the planning commission was involved. I'm not as familiar with that project as I probably could be. But I know that they had a lot of existing nonconformities that they were able to maintain, and so I think that's part of the size. And it's going to be projects like these that, as we go forward and review our design guidelines and you know, look at them to see how they're working, that these are issues that, you know, we can use as examples to see what could be done better, where we can improve.
Okay. Well, it's good news that we have 9 applicants. So
it's great news.
The deadline to apply, it's not too late, is Friday by 5 p.m.
Correct.
And people can just do that online?
Yep, you can go online. You can print off the form and you can submit it. It just has to be notarized. And there's lots of notaries at City Hall. So we'll help you out if you bring it in.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Thank you, Leslie, for helping us, you know, broaden the interest and appreciation for historic preservation.
So, John, you're moving on. You said you've got a job at the
Historic. Well, I've accepted a board position over at the Historic Park City Alliance, which is the Main Street Business Alliance Group, and hopefully we can help along the way there.
Okay. Hey, John and Anya, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
KPCW News Time now, 8:54. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. The annual Young Riders Bike Swap coming up this Mother's Day weekend. In the studio with details, I have the Executive Director of Young Riders, Heinrich Peters. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So I mentioned this weekend. When and where?
This weekend. So first and foremost, I just want to let listeners know that youngriders.com is our website, and that's really, there's a lot of information involved with the bike swap. So if you don't catch everything here, it's best to just go to our website and all the information's there. So the swap is this weekend, the 9th and the 10th. On Saturday, it is from 8 to 5, and on Sunday, it is from 11 to 3. And so that'll be your opportunity to come and purchase a lightly used or owned bicycle. There'll probably actually even be some new ones there. Some of the bike shops drop off some of their old inventory. But that'll be your opportunity to purchase a bike. If you are looking to put a bike in the swap to sell, today is the last day to drop them off at Jan's and White Pine. And then tomorrow at the yard, we have, you can come between 3 o'clock and 7 p.m. And Friday between noon and 8, and you can drop off your bike and we'll help you price it, et cetera, and get it into the swap.
Okay, so it's in the yard near where? Behind the Boneyard and stuff? Or
yeah, great question. So, we've been, thanks to Mark Fisher and Mike Sweeney and everybody at the yard, we have been in that event space behind the barnyard or Boneyard, sorry, for several years now. So it'll be in the same location. We'll actually have the parking in the back of the old Anderson Lumber area this year. You know, that area has seen a little bit of development, so we want to reserve parking for some of the businesses there. So
off of Homestake then.
Off of Homestake, yeah. And there'll be signs up directing people to that area.
All right. How much to get in?
It's free. You know, we've talked, you know, I think I've done this for 12 years myself, and we've done it for years before that. We've always, you know, had that question, do we charge money? But we see this as much as a community service, as a fundraiser for Young Riders. I think people, recognize that it happens every year. It's a good opportunity for people to turn over bikes. And consistent with our philosophy, it's a really good opportunity as kids grow. You know, you can take, you know, your child who's grown out of a bike, put it back in the swap and get a new one. So I think it's again, it's a community benefit. It provides parents an opportunity to save some money and their kids can still participate in the sport.
All right. And what's the percentage that goes to young riders as the fundraising?
Great question. So we take 20% of the sales. And so what that goes to is our scholarship programs. Basically, our scholarship program is if you are in need of tuition or maybe even equipment, we do everything that we can to make sure that kids have this opportunity to experience this sport. And then it also goes to we try to make sure that all of our extracurricular activities, there aren't additional charges. So the kids go to the pool, the mark, or ride the lifts, et cetera, and things like that.
All right. So what doesn't sell?
What doesn't sell? That's a great question. So first of all, we do mountain bikes, road bikes. We do kids bikes, adult bikes, bike accessory, you name it, bike everything. What doesn't sell is if you come with a bike that doesn't work, with flat tires. You know, bikes will sell if they're dirty, but I can tell you that from doing this for a long time, even if you just take 20 minutes to just clean the chain off, clean the frame off, you can usually get like $50 more for a bike. It's surprising, sometimes $150, $200, $300 more if you just take, you know, an hour and clean the bike up, make sure that the tires are aired up, you know, and it's functional. You know, pedals are always an issue. Some people don't bring pedals in, and we encourage people to, if you want to keep your pedals, at least bring flat pedals because people want to test ride them and things like that. And, you know, you've got, 800 bikes to choose from. So, you know, if you pick up a bike and it doesn't have pedals on it, it's very quickly just gets put back, or if it's got a flat tire. So really encourage people to you know, spruce up their bike, et cetera, and make sure it's in good working condition.
All right. You take cash, checks, and credit cards?
We do. What is new for this year, we worked with a local company. We've created actually a swap app. And so everything now is checked in on iPads. A picture is taken of the seller, of the equipment. We print off through these little printers. We print off the tags. And then information, like as soon as your bike is sold, you get an email. So, you know, you're aware of what your bike sold at or equipment, et cetera, and at what price. So we're trying to make it as streamlined as possible and communicate well with our sellers and buyers.
Okay, so the app is available now?
Well, we have it on our iPads, et cetera, and stuff. And so we're going to go through this test run, and then we'll look at, getting that out maybe in the future. So can I touch base real quick? Mountain Trails will be there. Summit County Health will be there. The Park City Police Department will be there. They'll be doing the bike rodeo. Dr. Delgado from Summit Pediatrics, talking a little bit about traumatic brain injuries. We'll be talking on Randy's show this evening about it. And Midweek Bike Series. So there's going to be a lot of people there. There's a little bit of festivities. We hope the weather looks a little bit better than the forecast, but we're excited.
Okay. Heinrich, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Assemble Park City, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.